Hey, good day, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. It's good to see all of my friends and former coworkers here, all in your respective advised offices. It's nice to see. Apparently, there are no meetings for any of you to hold, but I appreciate you being in the advised virtual live conference room. It's a little bit like the NHCA. It's virtual, but it's live. It's live, but it's virtual. As always, I'm joined by my compadres. I've got Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from the LA field office, now a member of our SIU investigative team. Jason Eisengrein, retired senior executive from HHSOIG, the retired UPIC Northeast director, and now our special director in charge. And Matt Kachansky, Jason's counterpart, retired OIG senior executive and retired Northeast UPIC director, and one of the managers on our SIU team. So we want to talk this week about, so first we want to do a quick recap of NHCA, the National Healthcare Anti-Fraud Association. For those of you that aren't familiar with that, they do every year is the annual training conference. It's held in different places. This year it was held in Dallas, Texas. Jason and I were there representing Advise along with Jean-Marie Loria, our chief executive officer, Rachel Jones, our president, and Dan Leslie, our national sales director. We did vend a booth, or we were a sponsor at a booth, as well as attending the conference. And it's a great way to meet people. If you've not been to an NHCAA and you're in an organization that can go to the NHCAA, it's definitely worth the time and effort to go. They do a ton of training and education sessions along the way. I had the pleasure of speaking with one of the directors of one of the Blues, which is one of our clients here at Advise. We talked about the public-private partnership. Now, we talked about it really from the perspective of the law enforcement community and the SIU community and some of the misalignment perceptions that may be there. But the reality is that we believe that the SIU community and the law enforcement community are more aligned than people really think, that the goals are often very similar. And one thing that came out of that training was that SIUs are typically the receivers of information and training when it comes to dealing with the law enforcement community. Like, we actually think that SIUs can do a lot to provide training to the law enforcement community in a couple of ways. One is oftentimes the law enforcement community doesn't even know what information the SIUs have that the law enforcement community can get a hold of via subpoena, or through requests for information or cover letter requests and the like. And so at least from a training and education perspective, there's opportunities for the law enforcement community to learn what sort of information and data is available. The other thing I think that makes the reverse training interesting is that oftentimes the law enforcement community doesn't understand what SIU's internal workflow processes are, what SIU's goals are, what their policies and procedures are and the like. And so oftentimes the frustrations that come about from the law enforcement community towards an SIU could probably be alleviated to some extent if there was a greater understanding of what the roles and responsibilities of an SIU organization is. And so I do encourage our viewers and listeners who are on the SIU side to reach out to your law enforcement partners and try to set up some reverse training. It shouldn't all be about receiving information. It can be about giving information. And we did get a lot of positive feedback during our talk about that. But I think I want to start with, as always, we talk a lot about data. We talk a lot about data on the SIU space. We talk a lot about data and understanding your data from the provider space. And we talk about data as a compliance tool within a provider community. But, you know, one of the things that Jason and I noticed while we were together at NHCAA was that there were really a very large number of data analytic vendors. And the ATC's sponsorship in the expo hall, the exposition hall, as they call it, was very heavily centered on data analytics and data vendors. I think I counted somewhere in the area of 12 to 15 vendors that appeared to be strictly in the data analytics space. There were a couple that do kind of a dual role. They're doing data analytics, they're doing validations, they're doing credentialing and things of that sort. But, you know, when you're talking about 15 or so data analytics vendors, it's, you know, almost like I was comparing it to Rube Goldberg. If you remember, you know, Rube Goldberg was always remember the game Mousetrap? It was building a better mousetrap. It's like, how many ways can you really make data look better, make it sexier, make it look more palatable, have more of what they call AI and ML? And I still don't fully understand, you know, artificial intelligence and machine learning is only as good as the people that are interpreting the data. And in talking to some of the vendors, I learned that a lot of them really don't have strong subject matter experts in fraud, waste, and abuse. They have people that are inordinately educated in the development of data and in processing, and they have some subject matter expertise in billing and coding. A lot of them have nurse CPCs. A lot of them have CPCs with very extensive experience, but very few did I find that really had intrinsic fraud, waste, and abuse investigative experience. And not to sound with hubris, but they didn't really have the OIG roundtable people of the world. There are very few that really do that. The position that I was really looking at was, when you have that data, how good is that data if you don't have people in there to kind of help with validating it? And so I'm going to take the position that data lies, because the data is only as good as the information that's provided and then the ability to interpret it. The example I always give to people when we have these conversations is, if you have a political candidate and that political candidate has a 90% approval rating, which no one on this planet has right now, but if you were so lucky to live in an area with a political candidate with a 90% approval rating, somebody is going to go and tell you they have a 10% disapproval rating, right? So data is always going to be based upon the interpretation of the person looking at that data. And data by itself is full of false positives, false negatives, and pathways that may not exist. So I'm going to take the position that, for the most part, data lies until someone tells you otherwise. And Jason, you and I have had some discussions about maybe it doesn't lie, right? Maybe I'm taking too strong of a position on this, right?
I think that's the way I would say your position is just too strong. Data as is just another source of information. So whether you're speaking to Medicare or a Medicaid beneficiary and getting information, or if you're speaking to some other third party witness, or you're looking at and this will really show my antiquation, if you're looking at a fast fact from Empire Blue Cross Blue Shield from 1972, it's all just a piece of information. And the good news is that our jobs and the jobs of probably 92.5%, and that's a data joke right there, of our audience, is that our jobs are alive and well, and that it requires human intervention, analysis, and validation of that piece of information. Because in it, and I understand that, program integrity is comprised of many layers, including things such as recovery audit contractors that are very heavily based on the data analysis. And, where I'm comfortable and where I see me riding out my career is in the area where data is an excellent source of information and a clue, and now should be part of the process of validating it and getting other sources of information to corroborate it, so that you can make administrative, civil fraud, and criminal decisions based on that totality of information and the aggregate of it, rather than a simple, oh, look at that. 92% of the time it showed this, and therefore elephants really can hang from a daisy off of a cliff. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah, and the point you bring up, I think it's, for me, the thing that's interesting is, you talked about the Empire Fast Facts from, ever ago. But, there's a lot of similar instances, right? So, there's a CMS-funded project that is a public-private partnership, in which they do monthly studies that are then promulgated out to the membership. And they do those studies in a way that you can, as a payer, you can take that data and you can reverse engineer and pull that data into your own data analytics. But, the time would come that if you're so, if you're so heavily centristic in using data, then you don't ever get an opportunity to address your reactive cases or cases that are coming in other proactive ways, you know, such as complaints and things of that sort. So there has to be that balance, which means that you've got to have a good triaging team and a good vetting team. And, you know, and Jason, one of the things that you're doing currently, you know, about 40 hours a week is working with a medium-sized plan that's one of our clients on exactly these kinds of things: process improvement, the integration of solid data analytics, the ability to vet those data analytics to ensure that the data is not lying to you, and that human interaction that comes into play in that, because you need to ferret out those false positives. And then also the false negatives, because there may be something that's there that's not, you know, the case. And, you know, I'm working on something right now where a provider, among other things, was indicted for a bunch of things, but they were one of the things that was part of the indictment was an analysis of an impossible day using CMS's estimated time calculations, which are really just made up. You know, I'm not going to say they're made up out of the ether. There's actually a group that meets several times a year to kind of calibrate those things. And interestingly enough, back in 2013, there was an article that was written by the Washington Post relative to estimations of times and sort of a general feeling that those estimates aren't necessarily accurate. So, you know, part of that metric is this discussion about whether or not the estimated times and the data that's resulting from those estimated times is really reliable or not. And so, Wade, I want to go to you next, because, you know, when you and I were talking about this, you brought up something that was pretty interesting. Now, obviously, data analytics are playing a strong role in where you are now on our SIU team with one of our big blue clients. And so you're seeing a lot of data that comes in and you're having to do a lot of data matching, particularly in the things like adult social daycare and all of that, where data is an important piece. You've got, you know, two pieces and they have to match. But Los Angeles was one of the cities that was designated as a strike force city. You know, currently now on the heat strike forces, there are about 14 of them, including now the two opioid task forces. But LA was one of the early strike force cities. You know, Miami was there, then it was New York and LA. And you brought up a good point when we were talking the other day about the fact that LA did not immediately embrace the strike force model, which is predicated upon low-hanging fruit and just going after providers' minimal investigative need, minimal field work, and a lot of it was centristic to data analytics. And you brought up the fact that at the LA office, that may have it's since changed, but data analytics coming out of the strike force wasn't the primary focus for the strike force in LA.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that was the original premise when it, you know, it started, like you said, in Miami, and I don't remember if LA was the second or third, right along with New York. But we had people from Miami come out to kind of teach us what they had done in Miami, and a lot of that was based on data analytics, where they had a data team that was going to run numbers and come up with subjects for us, targets. And they started doing that, but the targets that they were coming up with, frankly, weren't as good of targets as the ones that we were just naturally getting. We consider it like a target-rich environment. We had lots of subjects to go after. The data model works great if you're having trouble finding targets, or you don't have that many. You know, it'll shake the trees and you'll get targets out of it. But we had such a target-rich environment. They originally wanted to do the data model that they had used in Miami. And I took one of the Strikeforce attorneys down a road in the valley, I think it was Ventura Boulevard, and just showed them that there was literally within a 3 or 4 block area, there was like a ridiculous amount of DME companies. There was like 10 DME companies in a couple block area. And it's like, we can go off of the numbers that the Strikeforce data folks are coming up with. The billings that those companies had were much lower as far as like low-hanging fruit. They weren't billing as much as these ones that I could just show the attorney, say, here's this address, we'll go look it up and find out what they're billing and you know how many complaints we have from Benny's and that type of thing. So it just didn't I mean, some of the cases were developed from their data runs, but in general, we kind of took that aside and said, we really don't need to do that here. We have enough targets. that we can go after just based on our, not only the cases that we're already working and getting, like, you know, flipping people. You jam somebody up and they all of a sudden they want to tell you about all the other companies that they've been doing their fraud with. So we kind of took that approach more so than just the strict data runs that the Strikeforce data folks were doing.
Yeah, that's interesting that there were enough cases. Now, obviously, you know, if you look at the Strikeforce model now and the data analytics is vastly changed, it's a lot more accurate. There's a lot more data out there. OIG has got its own data. They've got these things called the Tiger Team now through CMS. But even within OIG, they've now got a data analytics team that's internal. But Matt, before I go to you, I want to go back to you, Jason, because this actually becomes a little bit of, from an operational perspective, a workflow and a process, meaning that if you've got so many cases that are coming in from other sources into your SIU or whatever it is running data just become piling on to a workload that's already being addressed in 100 other ways? And then what do you do with that data? Because data's got to be part of the metric, right? You're going to identify outliers that are going to result in the opening of cases and the prospect of there being overpayments, recoveries, referrals, educate, right? Data brings you a lot of things. But if you're so inundated with other cases, is bringing in data as another source of grief, how do you even manage that, right?
Well, it's unmanageable in its unfiltered form. So, you know, probably in your earliest days, you may remember those 12-inch thick binders of pin-printed claims. And I see some head nodding going on. And there was one gentleman who actually was with the Office of Audit Services for OIG. And so he probably, you know, just was the one person that knew how to actually obtain data. So their data analysis was just simply printing out those pin-printed binders. And then people like, you know, you and I, Eric, would go through them and try to start to find some pattern in there, maybe some interviews that could be done to substantiate or even at least find out what the allegation might be. So it's obviously, you know, that was then and this is now. And now the filtering process is much better. So, you know, a good data analysis group will have a series of algorithms that, you know, are based on subject matter expertise. So to your point where, you know, people that are not involved in the investigation of healthcare fraud and abuse concerns, they don't really know how to, or let's put it this way, they can't efficiently filter that information so that it's useful to investigators. So those algorithms, whether they're based on no prior relationship or something else, it's not to say that a good old fashioned spike analysis isn't valid, but really, an SIU, a modern day SIU, has to be comprised of data analysis group, an investigation and audit group, and then a clinical group that can, you know, validate those concerns that are clinical in nature and throw into the clinical aspect coders as well.
Yeah, and you know, the point that you make on this is it's not just bringing these people together, but it's also when you bring them together, it's having a conversation about, is this code really something that we should be thinking about? Like, for example, go back to these impossible day scenarios, and the fact that, you know, oftentimes the false positive is if you have issues of incident two, and we don't want to get too deep into incident two, but if you have incident two, it could make a provider look like he's billing for more hours in a day that exists. Or, you know, there's one that I looked at recently where every single claim that the provider had his NPI attached to, right? They were looking at that and giving these estimated times, which may not even have been appropriate. One of them was that there were a whole bunch of toxicology screens, urine drug testing. Well, it's going out onto the NPI for the provider because it's his group and it's his name. But is the doctor with the NPI attached to that have anything to do with taking a urine sample, right? The doctor's not standing holding the cup while the patient is peeing in it, right? So, you know, it's a medical assistant, it's a clerk, it's someone else. Oh, well, we all want the docs. We all want that doc's name and number. But, you know, but so that's that's part of where you've got to have like somebody who understands, like a clinician, to come in and say, yes, a urine toxic, a urine drug test is something that would be billed out under that provider's NPI number, but the provider doesn't really have any involvement in that. So do you really add that in to an impossible day scenario, right? What's the estimated time doesn't really factor in. But so Matt, I want to go to you because that then brings into this whole thing that like when you rely too much on data and not enough on vetting out the false positives, it can have a disastrous effect on the direction that your case goes. And you could find that you are now working on uphill battle to prove a criminal, civil, or administrative case because there's so much of a heavy reliance upon the data itself.
Yeah, and I think it's more of a danger today than it ever has been. Just think about what you all have brought to the conversation today. You talked about NHCAA full of vendors talking about the latest and greatest in artificial intelligence and machine learning and making the investigator's job easier, doing more of their job in on the front end with data. And then you look at some of the work that's being done by the SIUs. How many of the SIU investigators actually go out in the field now? Or are they just desk auditors looking at the data, perhaps ordering some medical records that they look at themselves or turn over to the clinicians? But do they really get to whether or not there's intent? You know, or is it just what the data is telling them, leading them down cul-de-sacs where this is what the data says, I'm going to follow this investigation as well as I can from my desk. And then where it leads might not be where that case really is in terms of criminal activity, mistake. There's a continuum there, but that data is pointing them toward one avenue and not letting them branch off if they're relying too much on that data itself. You know, you look at that, the case we talked about previously down in Florida, where they followed the data that had the, you know, the lab test being done in the hospital. The data was wrong, but those investigators followed that data, believing it to be absolutely correct. And when they did the interviews, they interviewed according to what the data was telling them to ask, and they missed asking the important questions that would have led them to what that case was truly about. And because of that, you know, they got the acquittals in court, and now they're being sued because of the poor investigation they conducted. So that data mishandled led them to the wrong conclusion. I think that's becoming more and more of an issue because the investigative teams are being asked to do less and less because the data is there to do more and more. You know, and right. Some of the investigations that we do, you know, we have to ask permission to go out and interview the members or the provider. So instead, oh, we're just going to rely on the data. We're not going to go through those steps and wait 2 months for the payer to come back and say, oh yeah, go ahead and do it. And we're just going to do it and come up with an overpayment, not knowing whether or not there's intent there or not. So in either case, you know, criminalizing something that's a mistake or making something an overpayment that could, you know, could have actually been more than that is a ramification of relying too much on data and not doing that human element that Jason brought up or that Wade talked about, going and do the drive-bys and showing the prosecutor there's 12 DME companies within a stone's throw of each other. You know, we should be looking at those. Those things aren't being done as often as they were or as often as they should be. And I think it's because of the advances in data.
Well, I think that's part of it. But I also think that the other part of it is that to an extent, there's a lot of liability that's associated with sending SIU investigators in the field, right? There's an increased cost to that. I mean, it's not like every SIU investigator has a car with, with undercover plates where they can be protected on their identity. So you've got issues involving transportation and things of that sort. You know, if there's a field visit that can be done or an interview on site that can be done, and it's an hour and a half or 2 hours away, does an SIU have the manpower to send two investigators in the field, not knowing what they're going into or any of that? I mean, you know, whether you want to glorify it or not, as law enforcement agents, we were given a number of tools of the trade to allow us to do that kind of work, right? And if you were sitting at your desk and you weren't in the field, you know, you weren't really getting the information that you needed. You know, law enforcement officers have, you know, we had cars, we had firearms, we had things, you know, self-defense training. We had some tools of the trade to be able to make us have a level of comfort to be able to go out. Some SIUs are small. You know, some SIUs may only have two or three people, and they may be all over the state. So how do you even get, you know, to that next level where you can go out and do that? So, you know, that does become an inherent challenge. But I think you're right. At the end of the day, there are a lot of things, and we do tend to rely a lot more heavily upon data as a fact than data as an investigative tool or lead. I think anything that we do in this space, any piece of information that you gather is really nothing more than an investigative lead based upon a tool. And at the end of the day, you know, someone is making a decision that there are enough investigative leads out there that say, hey, this is a problem, right? So data is a tool. And I think you're, you know, to an extent, you're right, that there is this very heavy reliance upon data, and that what the data says is what the data says, and there should be no turning back around from that. Because the data says it must be true. And, you know, I think that the data is the data, and where it lies, but you always need to be able to vet it out. I mean, even when you're talking about doing something like a statistically valid random sample of records, you still need, once you've looked at those records, you know, you still need to look at those records. You still need to come up with whether or not it's a yay or a nay. You can't just say, hey, statistically, from a statistically valid random sample, this provider bills 99215 90% of the time. And we know that E&M's billed at 99215 have the highest error rate. You can't just go and ascribe that error rate and then just say, okay, we're done. You owe us this money, right? There has to be this vetting of things. And, you know, it's putting these pieces of the puzzle together that help you do it. But, and I guess to bring this back home, I was really, you know, we know that there's a lot of vendors in the AI ML space, in the data analytics space. And it's not just here in healthcare, it's everywhere. But when you go to these conferences and you see that there are more and more companies exhibiting that are more and more like that. And, you know, we were really the only company that was there that was providing a full service offering of data analytics and services to the level that we produce it at. We had a lot of people coming up to us that, you know us and that are our clients that said, you're kind of a unique, Advise is kind of a unique company in the space, because we're not a publicly traded company that's got, you know, 100,000 employees where it's kind of cookie cutter. It's what's your flexibilities and what's out there to kind of help to shape that. So, I mean, it's obviously not going away. Data analytics is an important piece of this. And I think it's just a matter of fitting in from an investigative perspective where your analytics lie and lie as in where they sit, and whether or not they lie as in, are they giving you the factual truths to these. So Jason, I want to give you the last word on this, because, you know, you're spending a lot of time on this process improvement piece with one of our SIU clients. And that SIU client has now brought in our data analytics and services to help with that client to work to grow and shape and form their SIU. And a lot of that comes in with processes and policies. What kind of feedback are you getting from this particular client on sort of bringing analytics in the robust fashion that we're doing?
Well, I think it's refreshing, frankly, to see that with all of the hope and praise of things like AI and scientific approach to rooting out fraud and abuse in healthcare, it really, again, comes down to those are great tools, but it's about the human intervention. I don't mean to be repetitive, but I just think it's that important. And along with the human intervention, it really is a cross-section of the specialties. So having data science folks, as well as investigative and audit folks, and then finally clinical coding type of services, it ties together the I'll call it the three pillars of what it is that we do. But you mentioned it earlier, and I didn't, and it's so important, is management of those services. I'm sorry to be chuckling, but you know, this doesn't work on autopilot. If autopilot, and I'm sure that at some point AI will get to the point where maybe even I'll be satisfied with it, but call your cable or your satellite provider about something not working, you're not getting your local channels or something like that, and go through those voice prompts. And, you know, are you satisfied with that result? You know, that's ultimately, you know, is, you know, if that's for, and I know this is menial and probably a little bit unfair, but if that's the result of what's available where it's completely virtual, it's just not effective. And frankly, it's not fair to the members, beneficiaries, and definitely not fair to the providers as well, because you said it earlier, which is that, okay, so if data is giving you something, some wrong direction, yeah, that's probably true. I mean, haven't we spoken to a dozen beneficiaries over a particular issue? And they said, no, I was in and out of the doctor's office in 5 minutes. And look at here, they billed for the highest level E&M code. Aha. Well, you know, is that fair to the provider to kick them out, prosecute them, request money back or whatever else? No, it involves more specific analysis of the situation, as you said, by pulling records, looking, maybe there's a timestamp on the records, or at least a notation of what was discussed, and it, all of a sudden it kind of deflates the allegation of concern. And that's what this is about, is it's a fair assessment of the situation, because the outcomes that we're all expecting from this are in people's pocketbooks, sometimes even their freedom. So it's really important to get it right.
Yeah, it's a lot to digest, and we'll keep these conversations going, because I think, you know, the data analytics it's not going away, obviously. And it's just a matter of trying to learn and understand where all that data is going to be of probative value versus be a hindrance to your ability to do your job and get from point A to point B, particularly in a world where there's so much information coming into an SIU that you've got to be able to make sure that you're spending your time on what we're calling, right, the high quality investigations, which lead to either high quality referrals to law enforcement or a high quality resolution to the case. So ongoing conversations, it's good stuff. The ATC is always a great place to learn and connect and meet with people to hear what their thoughts are on things. So it's good stuff. For those of you that did not have an opportunity to tune into our LinkedIn Live that occurred this week, we had a great LinkedIn Live that took place this week. Matt Kachansky, Greg Lyon, and moderated by our new president, Rachel Jones, just kind of on the landscape of the SIU world and case management and the like. So you can find that on our YouTube channel. Go to YouTube and just look for Advise. You can subscribe to the YouTube channel. You can get that as a recording, as well as all of our historical OIG roundtables that come out every week. So keep on that. If you're not getting our newsletter, feel free to sign up by reaching out to us at hello@advizehealth.com. I think next week we're probably going to take it off, because it is a short week because of the holiday. So if we don't see each other, we don't talk. Have a great Thanksgiving, and then we're already into the Christmas season. It goes by very quickly, and we'll be back. Wade has already shoveled his driveway 57 times today, because now up in the nether regions of Wisconsin, it's now snowed, and then up in the north has come out. So Wade, we look forward to seeing you again tan August 25th, which is apparently summer in Wisconsin. So again, if you're not getting our newsletter, if you're not signing up, you're not getting the information, hello@advizehealth.com. Also remember, we start our nurses boot camp January 9th, twice a week. Live, virtually live, live instructor, live instruction. It goes from January until April. You can take advantage of some early bird pricing to get in. We have some slots that are still out there, but they are filling up quickly. So you can reach out to us if you have any questions. You can find all the information on LinkedIn and some of their social media about signing up. It is twice a week, 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern time, Tuesdays and Thursday nights. Give you all the information you need to be able to prepare you to sit for the CPC exam. You've got to have a nursing background because we are providing limited instruction on things like anatomy, physiology, and pharmacology. We really want the nurses to be able to focus on the coding sets and things of that sort. So that course starts January 9th. We do encourage you to sign up early to take advantage of the early pricing so that you aren't paying the full boat for that. And we do have some pricing payment options that are there. So if you're not getting that information you want it, you can reach out to me on my email or again at hello@advisehealth.com. Until next time, we'll see you guys and have a great day.
Yeah.
Thank you.